Well, I want to acknowledge right up front the inherent problem with doing a series on humility, okay? Particularly some people doing series on humility. It's even worse because I'm meant to be writing a book on this topic. So the problem is, I guess, that it suggests that you think you're an expert on the topic. It's interesting, isn't it? Because if I were doing a series on generosity or on prayer, you know, I wouldn't feel coy. Okay? No one would think, oh, you think you've got tickets on yourself as a prayer if I did a series on prayer. But as soon as you do a series on humility, I become uncomfortable. So let me make clear up front that I am not speaking from the perspective of an expert. Perhaps the opposite. This series, quite honestly, is part confession of my own failings as a Christian, part therapy, and part working through with you number three of my 2010 New Year's resolutions, be more humble. I need to say this is not a winsome, self-deprecating way to begin a series on humility, by the way, right? Get that out of your mind straight away, because I know those who know me best know that this is a real problem for Dixon. I think I'd have to say this is my greatest conscious struggle as a Christian, the struggle to be humble. I, in fact, have psychological evidence of this. As part of Centre for Public Christianity Professional Development, we were sent off to do the DISC analysis. DISC is a psychological analysis of people's work habits and personality profiles. And DISC stands for dominance, influence, steadiness, and conscientiousness. And you're sort of graded, you know, you do this sort of hour test, and then you're graded along these four quadrants. I'm not even going to pretend to keep you in suspense about where I fell on the DISC. I tend toward D, dominance. Now, actually, I was intending to read to you from just some choice lines from the full report that analyses my particular profile. And when Buff read through this yesterday, she said, there's no way you should read that out to them. I said, like it's going to surprise anyone? And she said, I think it will. So I'm not going to read it. But suffice to say, I'm not speaking from a position of strength when it comes to this issue of humility. It is, as I said, part therapy. Now, before this gets too Oprah Winfrey for us all, let me move straight into a definition of humility, because it's incredibly misunderstood. And what I want to do today is really just three things. I want to give you a definition of humility. I want to talk a little about the beauty of humility. And then I want to talk about the origin of humility. But first, the definition. First, let me explain what it does not mean. Humility does not mean humiliation. Even though actually the two words, humility and humiliation, come from the one Latin word, humilitas, and I'll explain how that's the case in a moment. Nor does humility mean being a doormat for others. You can be humble and assertive and steely-willed. In fact, I've read a recent report on this that actually says very often humility goes with steely will, and we'll be talking about that on the third week, I believe. Nor is humility low self-esteem, just thinking low thoughts about yourself. I actually believe, and I'll touch on this tonight, it's very difficult to be humble if you have a low self-esteem. That to be humble in the true Christian sense, you need to have a self-esteem. All become clear in a moment. Nor does humility mean denying your strengths and achievements. In fact, some of the most influential people in history have been people of great humility. And humility was a key to that greatness, in fact. And humility certainly doesn't mean having no convictions about the truth. As if, you know, firmly believing that Christ was the Lord of the whole world, a truth that relegates all other truths, is inherently arrogant. You often hear that today. And I don't deny it can be held arrogantly and expressed arrogantly, but it is not inherently arrogant to hold very firm views about things. I love G.K. Chesterton's take on this in his lovely little book, Orthodoxy, and I owe this quote to Scott Walters, who found it for me this week. But listen to this, classic G.K. What we suffer from today is humility in the wrong place. Modesty has settled on the organ of conviction, where it was never meant to be. A man was meant to be doubtful about himself, but undoubting about the truth. This has been exactly reversed. so true. So what is humility? Well, the etymology or origin of the word tells us that it really means low, as in low to the ground. Both the Latin humilitas and the Greek equivalent tapenos mean low, as in low to the ground. Now, you can use this either negatively or positively. Negatively, it means being put low from a great height. In other words, being humiliated. Positively, it can mean deliberately lowering yourself. And that's the concept we're talking about in terms of humility. Now, the ideas are the same but radically different. One is the awful experience of being publicly shamed by someone else. The other is the very noble, beautiful quality of deliberately lowering yourself for others. And that's the dominant usage amongst the early Christians, interestingly, even though the dominant usage amongst Greeks and Romans was this sense of being humiliated. I'll say more about that in a moment. I want us to think about three ideas as we reflect together on the passage, Philippians 2. I hope you've got that open. I've forgotten the page number already. What page is it? 1162. If you don't have it open, please make sure you do. Because I think we find in this passage the perfect description of Christian humility. And as I read it again, I want you to notice these three things on the screen. Humility assumes a great height or nobility of the one being humble. Secondly, humility is a willful or deliberate act. And humility is for the good of others, not just some private act of self-deprecation. Philippians 2, verse 3. Do nothing out of selfish ambition or vain conceit, but in humility, tapenos, consider others better than yourselves. Each of you should look not only to your own interests, but also to the interests of others. Your attitude should be the same as that of Christ Jesus, who being in very nature God, did not consider equality with God something to be grasped, but made himself nothing, taking the very nature of a servant, being made in human likeness. And being found in appearance as a man, he humbled himself and became obedient to death, even death on a cross. Did you notice these three things as I read? Did you notice, firstly, that humility in the Christian tradition assumes the high dignity of the one being humble? In the case of Jesus, of course, verse 6, in very nature God, he humbled himself. It's extraordinary. And in the human case, we're made in the image of God. And you need to have a clear understanding of the image of God in order to be truly humble in the Christian sense. This is a very important idea to process. I want to dwell on this for a moment. And I want to dwell on it sort of somewhat controversially by saying this. It is, I think, impossible for an atheist to be humble in the Christian sense. I know that's controversial, and I don't mean it's impossible for an atheist to act humbly and be kind and gracious. I think atheists can match and outdo any Christian when it comes to ethical behaviour. Don't mishear me. I'm speaking about the theoretical level here. It's impossible for an atheist to be humble in the Christian sense of the word. Think of it this way. If you believe that you and all humankind are an accident in an unknowing universe of blind genetic replication, where there is no rhyme or reason, no good or evil, just DNA and we dance to its music. That's a quote from Richard Dawkins describing his worldview. Then acting humbly is nothing other than outworking your actual low status in the universe. Can you see that? Buddhism actually has a similar dilemma that I'll be speaking about next week, because Buddhism teaches non-self, anatman, that you actually don't exist. And the Buddhist notion of humility is simply the practice of non-existence. It is radically different from the Christian concept of humility, which assumes your high and glorious status as a child made in the image of God, choosing to be humble. Very, very different concepts. And this is the second point I want us to dwell on here, that humility is a deliberate act. Look at verse 7. Jesus made himself nothing. No one made him nothing. He made himself nothing. Verse 8, he humbled himself. No one humbled him. And verse 3, in talking about us, it says, consider others better than yourselves. hegeomai, to consider, means to regard or count something to be the case. It isn't saying just think low thoughts about yourself. It isn't saying everyone's better than you. You are to count others as if better than yourself. Do you see? It's a decision. Humility is an act of the will. And thirdly, in my definition of humility, humility is for the good of others. Notice verse 4. Look not only to your own interests, but to the interests of others. It's about serving other people. Humility is a social virtue. It isn't a private act of piety. This is also very important to understand. Humility is not about just thinking self-deprecating thoughts. Humility is actually about engaging the world of others for service. And of course, Jesus is the great model here. He emptied himself, he humbled himself all the way to the cross for others. This was not just some private act of self-deprecation on the part of Jesus. It was an act of service to the world that the one of highest dignity chose to serve. And so we've arrived at a working definition of humility, in the Christian sense anyway. Humility is the noble choice to forego your status, redirect your resources, and hold your powers for the good of others before yourself. Humility is the noble choice to forego your status, redirect your resources, and hold your powers for the good of others before yourself. This is a stunningly beautiful quality in the Western tradition. In the West, we love it when great people are humble, don't we? I mean, when they're arrogant and sort of self-aggrandizing, we can't stand it. But when they lower themselves for the good of others, we love it. It's attractive to us. Perhaps, well, one of my favourite examples anyway is Sir Edmund Hillary, who by all accounts was an incredibly humble man. But this is a man who achieved, you know, one of the greatest human achievements, conquering Mount Everest in 1953 with Tenzin Norgay, let's not forget him. An astonishing thing. Climbers today still find it hard to believe that he could do it with the limited equipment that they had in 1953. But Sir Edmund devoted himself to the Nepalese people ever since that day, trying to give back to them something of the fame and wealth and everything he got from Nepal. And so he set up orphanages and all sorts of things across Nepal. And Sydney Morning Herald, just before he died, did a story on him in which they told this story. They said Sir Edmund was in Nepal doing one of his orphanage trips, and this group of trekkers spotted him, recognised him, and wanted a photo with the great Sir Edmund Hillary. So they all gathered around him, gave him a little ice pick to make it look better, and they all gathered around him for the photo. And another trekker walked by who didn't recognise Sir Edmund Hillary and came up to him and said, "Excuse me, that's not how you hold an ice pick. Let me show you." Proceeded to adjust the ice pick in Sir Edmund's hand. To everyone's stunned amazement, Sir Edmund simply thanked the man and went on with the photo, nothing else. Now, I don't care how great that other climber was, his greatness is diminished, isn't it? And yet Sir Edmund's greatness is enhanced by his humility. It's a humility that marked his whole life. Now, the reason I tell you that, because I want you to notice how that story works for Westerners. You love hearing a story like that. Your estimation of Sir Edmund goes up when you hear that, but here's the interesting thing. That has not always been the case. In the ancient world, Greece and Rome, humility was not a virtue. Doing what Sir Edmund did was not counted as virtuous or ideal. In fact, quite the opposite. The word humilitas and tapenos meant humiliation. That was its primary meaning, servitude. And you could be humble toward the gods for obvious reasons. They could kill you. And humble before the emperors for the same reason. But humility toward an equal or a lesser was regarded as ill-advised, unethical. Why? Because ancient Mediterranean societies are what historians call honour-shame cultures, where the greatest good in such societies is to achieve honour for yourself or your nation or your family. The greatest good. And the greatest evil was to experience public shame as a nation, as an individual, or as families. At CPX, we had the great privilege of interviewing Edwin Judge, one of Australia's leading historians of things ancient, and he explains it. Ready.
Edwin Judge is a distinguished scholar of Roman history and regarded as one of the most important social historians of early Christianity. In fact, in a recent volume of his collected works, the editor described Professor Judge as a turning point in scholarship and the new founder of what has come to be called the social scientific criticism of the New Testament. We at CPX are honoured to capture some key thoughts of this truly outstanding scholar.
Edwin, thanks for joining us. Today we take for granted that humility is a good thing and boasting is a bad thing, but that hasn't always been the case, has it?
It was certainly not the case in Homer's day, at the beginning of Greek culture, and it certainly wasn't the case in Roman times, like in the lifetime of Cicero just before Christ. In both of those periods, it was taken for granted as an active, positive, cultural and ethical good that one should display oneself to advantage and parade oneself and claim high status on grounds of merit. You owed it to the good and great to celebrate their grandeur, and it was right for the good to seek it because Cicero said, without that, there was no assurance of immortality.
This ties into one of the distinguishing features of ancient Mediterranean society, that it was an honour-shame culture. Can you tell us a little about what that means to be an honour-shame culture?
Well, it presupposes merit. You have honour because you have merit, and merit deserves honour. In the case of Homer, for example, it's quite clear what the merit was. It was personal, physical valour in warfare, what we mean in the crudest terms by courage. Leadership required that, but it required also the ability to persuade. Valour and eloquence went together in Homer as the entitlement to honour. And if you were dishonoured by somebody humiliating you, for example, in a public way, that was a devastating injury which generated a vendetta of recrimination and revenge. And the reason for this is that just as honour was the evidence of merit, humiliation was the evidence of worthlessness. It wasn't just that you'd been injured, but that you'd been pronounced.
I want to give you a sense of the difference between ancient and modern cultures on this issue of honour and glory by reading to you the opening paragraphs of an autobiography written in the first century. It's the autobiography of Josephus, the aristocratic Jewish general and historian who lived out his years under the patronage of the emperors in Rome. And the opening words of his autobiography will strike us as slightly perverse, but wouldn't have raised an eyebrow in his day. Have a listen to this. "My family is not an ignoble one, tracing its descent far back to priestly ancestors. Different races base their claim to nobility on various grounds. With us, a connection with the priesthood is the hallmark of an illustrious line. Not only, however, were my ancestors priests, but they belonged to the first of the 24 courses, a peculiar distinction, and to the most eminent of its constituent clans. Moreover, on my mother's side, I am of royal blood. I will give the pedigree," and then he goes on and gives the pedigree. "With such a pedigree, which I cite as I find it recorded in the public registers, I can take leave of the would-be detractors of my family. Distinguished as he was by his noble birth, my father Matthias was even more esteemed for his upright character, being among the most notable men in Jerusalem, our greatest city. Brought up with Matthias Jr., my own brother by both parents, I made great progress in my education, gaining a reputation for an excellent memory and understanding. While still a mere boy, about 14 years old, I won universal applause for my love of literature. insomuch that the chief priests and leading men of the city used constantly to come to me for precise information on some particular of our ordinances. You wouldn't hear that sort of thing anymore, apart from perhaps high D personalities. But in the ancient world, it was the norm to speak like that and wouldn't have raised an eyebrow. Friends, something dramatic has happened in Western culture. And I want to talk about it. I was involved in a small way in a Macquarie-funded research project into the origins of humility as a social virtue in the Western tradition. Now, before you say, oh, that's really ironic, I need to say that my longest friend, Angus, was the first to point out the irony. When I rang him up and told him I was doing this little research project investigating humility, his instant response was, well, at least you have the objective distance from the subject. Anyway, what we found is that the origins of humility in the Western tradition begin in a sort of hinted way in the Old Testament prophets, with God's peculiar love for the humiliated, for the poor, for the oppressed. But that something very dramatic happens in the first century, and in particular around the death of Jesus. Jesus' death on a cross was the most shameful thing that could happen to an individual. I've said before that crucifixion was the summum supplicium, the ultimate punishment. It was the most shameful position in the Roman world. And here's the thing that happened. People began to think, hang on, if the greatest man we know willingly suffered on a shameful Roman cross, true greatness must consist in giving yourself on behalf of others, in willing to forego status, redirect resources, hold powers, for the good of others. And suddenly, and you can date it in the literature, humilitas and tapenos, these ancient words that meant humiliation, come to be used of a virtue, of choosing to lower yourself for the good of others. First in the Christian literature. Within a few centuries, everyone is using the language of humility as a social virtue. And our culture has never been the same since. Let's hear this from Edwin.
The Christians, though, viewed things slightly differently. They didn't buy holus bolus, this honour-shame paradigm.
It comes out of the prophetic tradition in Israel, and going back far beyond the prophets, I think, where a special privilege of God's favour is given to the poor. This comes up again and again in the tradition, and extremely clearly in Jesus' teaching. And Paul ran into problems with it in his churches because he was working under the protection of the old system. He was supported and patronized by people firmly entrenched in the honor structure, and he needed that. But because of his own personal humiliation as a result of his conversion, I mean, he'd been an important person. Then after his conversion, he was on the receiving end. As he went around synagogues, he was getting thrown out, publicly insulted and punished and so on. And all of these things he found deeply wounding as an honourable man. But he came in a way not to love them exactly, but to value them for a very specific reason, which he makes elaborately clear, because it identified him with the humiliation of Christ. And for him, the humiliation of Christ was key to the salvation of the world. And it was a paradox, of course, because you're not supposed to be saved by somebody who's defeated or reduced to the most disgraceful end. This is why the Romans couldn't accept Christ as a god.
To what extent, then, do you think the modern love of the virtue of humility is a Christian inheritance?
It is entirely a Christian inheritance, or Judeo-Christian. It certainly stems out of the Hebrew culture, but its sharp articulation comes to us specifically from the Gospel and from Paul's doctrines and the whole Christian tradition, which has made humility a kind of virtue. I'm quite certain Paul would never have classified it as a virtue. It's not like that. But that's how it comes into our culture. And the fascinating thing is that it's imprinted now in everybody in our culture, whether they're Christian or not Christian. And the Christians have exactly the same problem with it as the rest do. Anybody in our culture struggles, in fact, with a conflict between, in his personal life, between our heritage from the honor-shame culture, which values status and does not like being humiliated, and our inheritance from the gospel, whether we know the gospel or not, which says you are especially close to God in the humble position. And so we honor people who are truly humble, but we hate people who are only pretending to be humble.
What I'm actually saying is that humility came into Western culture as a virtue entirely because of the gospel story. So that now, whether people are Christians or not, they value humility. Such is the effect of Christianity on the West that what was once a very novel gift of Judeo-Christian theology now seems to most people as common sense. But there is also no doubt that humility is a peculiarly Christian idea, by which I mean it's a mindset that makes particular sense in the Christian view of things. And our passage makes this perfectly clear. If the greatest one we know willingly chose to forgo his status, redirect his resources, hold his power for the good of others, greatness consists in precisely that, humility. Humility is central to the Christian life because it is central to the Christian gospel. William Wilberforce, that great aristocratic MP who did so much to end slavery in the British Empire, called humility the vital principle of Christianity, and claimed that it was the thing he wanted most in life for himself and for his country. And he wrote this incredible manifesto in 1797 with this extraordinary title, A Practical View of the Prevailing Religious System of Professed Christians in the Higher and Middle Classes in This Country, Contrasted with Real Christianity. It's a very bold read. I really do commend it if you can get your hands on it. In it, he wrote about this principle of humility that fueled everything for him. Listen to these words. To a man of the world, this might seem a strange paradox, that in proportion as the Christian grows in grace, he grows also in humility. Humility is indeed the vital principle of Christianity, that principle by which from first to last she lives and thrives. This principle, during the Christian's whole progress, is the very ground and basis of his feelings and conduct, both in relation to God, his fellow creatures, and himself. I'll end here. I'm going to be exploring the practical outworkings and benefits of humility in the next 2 weeks, so I hope you can come back for that. But for now, I just want us to decide together to try and work out how humility might apply. How would life be different if we just chose to forego status a little more, redirect resources and hold our powers, whatever powers they are, for the good of others? What if we applied this to church life? What difference would it make to your serving and ministering here, to my leadership? What about how parents treat their children? How might humility apply? Children treating parents. What about how spouses speak to each other when no one's around? Or speak about each other when others are around? What about making love? Seriously. I don't want to embarrass anyone, but humility in lovemaking applies. What about in business life? The way you treat those above you, sure. But what about those below you who give you nothing? How do you treat them? The people of no consequence we meet, you know, every day. The checkout chick, you know, the painter who's helping you with your reno. How do we treat them? How do we speak to them? Are we humble? I think if we decide together over these next few weeks to try and think about how humility might apply to the various areas of life, I think by the end of this series you'll be agreeing with me that humility applies to everything. And the reason for this is that the Lord of everything is in his essential nature humble. So will you join with me in crying out to the humble Lord, by your Spirit, Jesus, make us humble.